I just have to introduce this at the top, Bob, that's okay. So I'm Marsha Amani, and here with Simon Hicks, and we're here today to interview Hickman. Sorry, Simon Hickman. And we're here today to interview Bob Trett. And it's Bob Trett, is that right?
T-R-E-T-T.
Okay. And we're at Killeen.
Yes.
And it is Thursday, April the 25th, 2019. So I'm just going to pop that down there, Bob. It is going. Yeah, there we go. I wonder, Bob, if we can start off. Sam and I are going to pitch in together.
Sure.
If you could just introduce yourself, who you are, your background.
Okay, right. Well, my name is Bob Trett. I wasn't born here, but I used to be a curator at different museums, and I was employed as the curator at the Newport Museum and Art Gallery in 1983. I have to try and remember that exactly. And I had a double job. One was being the curator, which, if you like, is administratively in charge of the Museum and Art Gallery, and to a lesser degree of Tredegar House when it was in the council's control. Although that had a very good curator there anyway, so didn't really have to do much. But the museum itself had moved in the 1960s, and they were still in the process of redisplaying it. The art gallery was fine, it had been completed, but most of the museum needed redisplaying. So one of the first jobs I was given by the council was to redisplay the museum. And there were various keepers there, staff, very clever people who knew a lot and in charge of collections. Some of them had been there for a long time. But the main collections were, if you like, the natural sciences, including geology, a good geology collection, and birds. In fact, including, I noticed, the last ibis shot on the seven levels, so way back some time. But so they had the natural history collections, various types of stuff, a lot of it stuffed animals, of course. They had a very good archaeology collection, mostly Roman, from the Roman town at Caerwent, which is on the edge of the levels, from excavations in the 1900s. They had a very good social history collection, local history collection, well, still do, of course. And then, of course, the art collections, which were on the floor above. So, and they all linked in pretty well as well. So my job, first of all, was to start the redisplays. And the first thing we did was to redisplay the medieval collection. A lot of that's now gone, but we did that because a lot of fresh medieval material was coming in, places like Skenfrith Castle, and from Penhow Castle, and from Lanterney Priory, and so on. So it was a county-wide collection. So that was displayed. A lot of help from Cadw and other people to put it together. And then the next section we did was on the local history collections, which started in the sort of 18th century, really. Included the Chartists, of course, because there's a good Chartist collection. And then on mainly on Newport industry and civic life and so on. And a lot of that is still there. It's adapted a bit now. But of course the port was there and they're still working and so on. So there was quite a lot of material which we couldn't show, but some of which we could for the very first time. And then we did the archaeology. Well, the first part of the archaeology was the prehistory. And they'd already had some cases put in. And we reckon there was about, the trouble was they weren't very secure, but there was about 13 items in the collections from prehistory of Gwent, not just Newport, and there was about 13 cases to put them in. So we were very short on material. And so what happened was that we started to cultivate lots of metal detectors. Some of them had actually been on the levels and out there. And I became involved with the Glamorgan Gwent Archaeological Trust. And they went out and they were a great help. But the man that gave the most help to us, because he came in with a load of unaged pottery, which had my eyeballs going out like this, was a man called Derek Upton. And Derek, I think, lived near Sudbrook. He was born out there. And he when even as a child, he used to say he would wander over the sea wall, as a, almost as a toddler, and wander out on the mudflats, and then came back and still alive. So he was a fascinating guy, and we came very, very close. So whenever he found anything, he would ring up and we would go out and have a look, and various other colleagues and volunteers I had helping me, including a gentleman called Steve Parry, who was very brilliant at, he was a sort of archaeologist come eco man, but he was very brilliant at spotting things. And so Derek would point out stuff. So I went down and had a little investigation in the channel where all his Iron Age pottery was coming out of. And these two went walking along the foreshore. This was, what's never the place of your name? Anyway, they finished up a place called Chapel Tump, which was a couple of miles away. They come running back and saying, "We've got a prehistoric platform there." And
this is out in the estuary?
This was in the estuary. And all sorts of stuff. So I went and had a look, and there they had, they were hurdles which had been laid down and were pegged in to the ground. But of course, no idea of dates. But we had contacts with the university in Cardiff, and we managed to get a whole series of radiocom dates done and things, and this turned out to be Iron Age. I can't remember offhand the date because I've been retired for so many years, but anyway, it was Iron Age before the Romans. And alongside it, they started finding Bronze Age pottery, and we found a Bronze Age working site, which they had bits of flint, obviously, were brought in, big pits in which they were burning stuff, and I even found a little bone piercing pin which had been manufactured. And so the stuff from Chapel Tump was quite important, and then it just snowballed from there. This was at I forgot the name of the place now. There's a pill down there, Magor Pill, which I started out from, and Derek found all sorts of other stuff out there of all different periods. So we then followed him to Goldcliffe, and we went out to Goldcliffe because he was discovering Mesolithic, some early prehistoric material coming up, broken bones and stuff that had been burnt, and there was obviously an island there, and the trees had been burnt off, but there are lots of things like, you know, boar and wild deer and sort of even the piece of a wild wolf on a jaw, I think. So they were all mixed in with the charcoal and stuff. So again, we were able to get it dated, and with some help from the university and the trust, Glamorgan Archaeological Trust, we managed to start some surveys off there as well. So this was all happening very well. The next thing, we walked on a bit further, and we started finding one thing after another, after another, after another. One of the most fascinating things which we found all the way along the foreshore was stumps of trees, or trees which had fallen over. And if you got there, you could be out there and you could be thinking you were actually in the forest, and if you just look down, you can see where all the trees were. So you know exactly how it was. And of course, the estuary is made up of layers of peat and layers of alluvium or clay, and there's sort of a whole sandwich of them. And each tide drops extra mud down. But of course, you get fierce storms and everything gets wiped away. So this is why all these things were being discovered. We had a great time going through this. And then we went a bit further on from Goldcliffe, as I was saying, and we bumped into it, more fishing traps, all sorts of stuff. And then we suddenly found a hut. Well, it's just the base of a hut, but it had partitions inside it, and it had a reed floor, And that turned out to be our ancient name. And it was part of a small settlement. And there were several of them around there. And I think people were probably using them for cattle because... and it was really sort of far too much for us to cope with on our own. And then because the next thing happened, Derek rang up very excitedly and said he'd just been off Nash, near the mouth of the Usk. And he'd come across, on the lower levels, embedded in the clay, a set of human footprints. We were busy photographing everything. So by this point, everybody knew what was happening. So all the archaeological bigwigs from around gathered together, and we had a meeting at the university, and the National Museum were there as well, because they'd found some additional items there. And we'd found an aurochs, which was quite interesting, at Nash as well, which is like a wild cow. And this was a massive big thing. And bits of it are on display in the museum. In fact, most of what's on display in the museum and the new prehistoric displays came from these discoveries in the Severn Estuary, together with some more material which was found by metal detector users inland as well. So so from having virtually nothing, we've finished up in quite an important collection covering the whole of prehistory, including hand axes, you know, which the earliest sort of type of artifact you tend to find, and very rare. And there are a couple that have been brought down by glacial action, I imagine, into the estuary, and so they're on display in the museum. I think the National Museum were a bit jealous of all this, but nevertheless, everyone was very cooperative, and it
so
was a group.
Nobody had really gone out and done what you had done.
Nobody really. No, there'd been one hut circle which had been excavated at Chapel Tump. That was known as Chapel Tump One, a few years earlier by Stephen Aldhouse Green, who was the prehistorian at the National Museum of Wales. But it had been a sort of one-off. There was other people working on the geology and the river flows and tidal things and all this. And, of course, the whole area was SSSI as well, so there was that aspect of it all. But nobody really looked there. And they'd looked on the other side, because obviously not Glastonbury, is it Glastonbury? Where, I can't remember what it's called now. It's because I'm getting old. But anyway, there all sorts of stuff come up from the wetlands on the other side. Here we are. Somerset Levels, yes, and little booklets like this shows the sort of stuff that they were finding. We were finding the similar things as well.
Yes.
There was an enormously important site there, whose name, near Glastonbury. So so that was the sort of stuff that was known about. But obviously the same thing was happening on our side. And after the prehistory on the mudflats, intertidal area, they started finding it in profusion on the landward side of the seawall. In particular, we found, when they were doing some excavations at Caldecott Castle, part of a huge plank which was part of a Bronze Age boat and various other things, which was done through the Archaeological Trust. But then another one they found was a Roman boat, a virtually complete small Roman boat called the Barlands Farm Boat, when they were putting in Gwent Euro Park. So with the help of the trust who were digging it, and the conservator we had, Kate Hunter, we excavated that. And that came in the museum, and that's in store with the remains of the Newport ship. Other boats had been, we also discovered there was about an 1800 canal boat up at Newbridge, up the Usk. But that was very early and all handmade. It's very interesting, but most of that sort of is now gone, disappeared. And
I mean, where's it gone?
Well, it was excavated, and it was, you know, how big a canal boat is, and they did it by putting a bund in the river, and they pumped it all out, and there was this boat, and this was excavated and recorded, and then they were thinking about what to do with it. And just at that moment, they had one of these flash floods. So the whole boat lifted out of the water.
Oh, no.
Not the water, the riverbed. Mm-hmm. And was taken over the bund and floated down several hundred yards till it smashed up against a bank. Now, the man who was advising us was a man called Professor Sean McGrail, well-known, eminent maritime archaeologist. And he said, well, it's actually not a bad thing because he can now look at all the bits individually, which is what they did. And the bits were then transferred to Newport to an old warehouse that's now gone. And they were recorded and a report published. And bits were left in the museum. And I don't know whether I think most of them are probably, they haven't kept.
How old was it?
About 1800.
Gosh.
But it was all handmade, and it was flat-bottomed. It was so similar in many ways to the Roman boat, which the way the fittings worked and so on. That was the interesting part of it.
Was it like a trow then? That sort of.
Well, no, it was a canal boat, you know, okay. Pointy at both ends, and it was obviously towed from a towing post up the river. I think it probably had a small mast as well, probably from up to Newbridge. And there was stuff used to come down the river from Newbridge to Killeen and then on to Newport, and when it was abandoned because it was old, they just put it onto the river bank to help the river defences. So that's how we found it. But that was the first one that created quite a stir.
But when was this? What sort of period was this? Was this the early 80s?
Well, it was probably built around about 1800 when the first canals were also coming in, although it seems to have been a river craft rather than a canal boat. It doesn't sort of fit in with the early Monmouthshire canal boats.
But it was found in the early 1980s, was it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I've got slides. The trouble is that I used to know this off by heart and I forget it all, but I've got the record still. And most of the stuff went into the museum, archives as well. So so that was the Tridenic boat. Then there was the Roman boat, the Barlands Farm boat. Then there was the Caldecott Bronze Age planks, but enormous. And then one medieval boat was found at Magor Pill. And quite frankly, we'd got enough going on to do that. So the National Museum were very keen to take that project on. So they did, and what remained of that boat went into the National Museum collections, not on show, but it's there. But, you know, in essence, there was almost unique collection of early boats of different periods that had been found. And it sort of would be nice at some point for them to all merge together and be displayed. But of course the jewel in the crown didn't happen until 2002 when the Newport ship, but that's a later story. I was in the museum till about 2000, and we had a steady programme of material coming in and recording it, and we were sort of in the early stages of computerising records, so all that came in. When I came there, there were handwritten cards and nice sort of volumes of accessions with little hand-drawn pictures and some places next to a description. And now, of course, it's all digital and everything else, so it's a totally different ballgame. And of course the photography, the fact that you get digital photography has changed everything, so and so all the old photographs mostly probably not some of the ones I've got actually, but have now been digitalised or on archives in the Grand Archives or the museum or wherever. So, and of course, the other aspect was a lot of publication went on as well. So that was my involvement, and.
But the Newport ship. So I mean, I think you described it as the jewel in the crown.
Mm.
Can you tell us about that? Then, what, you know, were you there when it was discovered?
What point did you
get involved?
Well, it's quite interesting because when I retired from the museum. I moved here and I was mainly doing guided tours around Caerleon, but I was still involved with the Glamorganquint Archaeological Trust based in Swansea, and for many years I'd been the chairman of the trustees, so I had a very close link with the staff there, and they were called in to do a watching brief on a piece of land which was where the new Riverfront Theatre was going to be. And they phoned me quite excitedly because Kate Howell, who was the girl that was running it at the time, said they'd found some curved timbers just underneath where the orchestra pit, we know all this anyway, so and so they were quite excited, and so it looked like it was a boat, and nobody, or a ship, but nobody knew how big it was or exactly what date it was. And it had a sort of key over the top, so it was probably pre-1800s, but that's about all you could say. So after some argument and debate with the council, who tried to keep very quiet about it.
Why did they try to keep quiet about it?
Well, because if this turned out to be a big, massive thing, it would hold the whole project up. They weren't insured for this sort of hold-ups, and it could have cost them... Well, it did in the end. Millions, you know.
Yeah.
So they kept very quiet about it. But, of course, I knew. Mm. Because through the trust, and also because my friendship with the staff in the museum was still there, because I used to go in and help them and tell them where things were and so on. It was agreed that they could excavate at least part of it. And which they did, and what they found was that it stretched from one side of where the orchestra pit was to the other side, a little bit missing on either end beyond this sort of massive big iron cofferdams being put in, but most of it was inside. You know, if you were going to plan an excavation and you had to put a pit in, you would almost put it where it is, maybe a bit longer just to get the stern and the brow in, but nobody still knew what the date was until one of our colleagues, Nigel Nayling, who's now a professor. I actually interviewed him for a job on the seminary a long time ago, but he's gone up in the world. And he's a dendrochronologist, and he was able to date a particular timber on mixed up with it to, what was it, 1457 or 8 or 9 or sometime around about then, and of course that made it internationally important. In the end it was discovered that his timber, I think, was a repair done in England, or proposed repair on part of the ship, but, and he found that, you know, there were bits had been repaired in England, but it took him a long time to get an actual date for the ship, which would seem to have been built in what we call the Basque Country in northern Spain. So,
what was the feeling? What was the sense? Was there great excitement? Was there?
Oh yes, yes. There was a lot of excitement, but of course, most of the public didn't know. But the word was getting around, and so I was told by a reporter when it did blow, you know, that. He rang up the council and they were saying, well, what boat is this? You know, they were denying its existence. But in the end, the truth came out. And
was there a risk that they could have covered it back over then? Was that the...
Well, I think, no, they couldn't even do that, because what they would have had to have done was to allow them to record sections of the ship, remove a few of the timbers, and the rest would have been bulldozed away, because it was in the orchestra pit. It was in the way. So we couldn't save it at all. But anyway, the news got out, and I was sort of interviewed by the reporter from the South Wales Argus, Mike Buckingham, and I explained, you know, to him what was going on, because the trust staff weren't allowed to say anything, and the museum staff weren't allowed to say anything, council wouldn't say anything, but as I was a sort of volunteer in the know, I could actually tell them. So, and then...
Did you get a lot of flack for that then?
I don't think they were very happy with me, put it right. But there's nothing they could do about it. You know, it was just so too important to pretend it didn't exist, and they didn't really know what they were doing.
Was there a sense that the people of the city and the area were behind the project? This is...
What happened was, immediately it got out, without me, mainly through Charlie Ferris and other people, they... set up a meeting to, and I was asked to talk, so I was one of the speakers, and they had international speakers coming along, you know, and this was held in the Dolman Theatre, and various things were said, and in the end, you know, it didn't seem to get anywhere. I said, well, look, as far as I understand it, you know, the Archaeology Trust, they haven't got any other option. They're the contractors. We'll have to move out in so many weeks' time, and then the ship will be destroyed. So and that gelled them. So then it became the Save Our Ship campaign, and the Friends of the Newport Ship. And they mounted a 24-hour vigil, having people tooting their horns and processions, and it was one of the most successful. I had some very clever people help them. Most successful, one of the earliest internet protest campaigns, and they actually brought down. Of course, didn't take much to do that. The local council's websites and everything else, plus I think they put a shock on to the Welsh Assembly, and we'd get people writing from or coming in from all over the world, literally, you know, from Australia, from America, obviously a lot from Europe as well, including virtually all the eminent ship archaeologists as well, Margaret Rules of this world, you know, and these sort of people, and so the campaign was huge. So it was obviously very clear to the council they had to do something. So they had a discussion with the CADW and then with the National Assembly for Wales. And they were offered, I think it was about £3.5 million, to pay for the excavation of the ship and the eventual display of the ship. But they were told they had to have somewhere where they could put it. So a big idea, without consulting any of the archaeologists or the museum people, was they build another big pit within the site of the theatre, and that would be used for displaying the Newport ship. So anyway, we were a bit dubious about it when I heard about it, but this is what was proposed. And... So they then agreed, you know, the campaign was won. Leader of the council, Sir Harry Jones, was seen down there, smiles all round, you know, we're going to take it up. And they had to take it up piece by piece, you know, you couldn't lift it out. And then it had lots of officer help, including British Steel, as it was then, you know, there was a warehouse there, and they took the tanks of water down there. Although they put the timbers down there, which had to be kept in water. Interestingly enough, they had to get water on this site and put in these big tanks in a large empty shed they had there. And they got the water out of the local reeds. And when we went and then look at it, it was absolutely infested with small shrimps and stuff like that, which was okay, it didn't do too much harm. And the timbers are so strong anyway. So they, in the end, they got some goldfish in, and somebody managed to get a baby sturgeon, which over the years I saw grow to about that, from about that. And they loved it, you know, sailing in until everything was washed and cleaned as part of the conservation process. Then there was a huge wrangle because the director of the trust had told them, and he hoped to get the ship out in about 6 weeks, which was clearly impossible. It took about 6 months. So I mean, without going into too many details, they said, okay, you go ahead and have the 6 months. Weren't very happy about it, and
they being the council.
The council, yeah. Yes. But it went ahead, and it was successful. In actual fact, it was very quick. You know, if you think of another site as big as that, you could be there for years, but they did it in about 6 months, cut it up. And
what were the numbers of the people working there? I mean, were they...
Well, they varied from 30 to 40 at the most, but they varied, and they had specialists came in as well, like Nigel and others. And I used to go along and annoy them because I was allowed to go in and photograph them, which was they were grateful for afterwards, because when they were reassembling it, I'd taken photographs of timbers which had been misplaced, so they could work out where they went, so that was all right. But it was a long job, and then I was really there as on a supporting level. I wasn't really in taking part in the excavation or the recording or the conservation process, which were all sort of you know, breaking new ground all the time, particularly in recording. Conservation had been done before, but this was new techniques coming in as well. Unlike the Mary Rose, for instance, this preserved much better and quicker, because of course it was all in bits and you could treat on the timbers individually. So, and the finds kept coming up, and so I got involved in looking at the finds as well. But of course, nobody knew exactly what the ship was. It was assumed it was a British ship. Most of them traded from Bristol, but it was a vast one, probably thought at that time to be about 300 tonnes, or could carry about 300 tonnes. They found barrel remains and everything else, including marks of merchants, and so I was delving into them. But there are a lot of the timbers there were obviously for rebuilding the ship, because it had been badly damaged, and massive timbers, and that's the ones that Nigel managed to date. So I was thinking, well, who on earth could afford to either repair or build a ship of this size? So that, and thanks to Newport, they gave me a bit of money to do some research. And so I went around researching various places, and I did a lot on medieval Newport, which found out for the first time. And one of the things I discovered was that at the time the Newport ship was in Newport, it had been towed in there, because it certainly didn't seem to be a Newport ship as such. It was right in the middle of the Wars of the Roses. And at that time, the man we all call Warwick the Kingmaker had actually succeeded in capturing Newport as part of territories of the then Earl, or the late Earl of Pembroke, as he soon became, losing his head. But it was all taken over by Warwick. And by looking through the archives, particularly in Warwick themselves and elsewhere, we were able to find out quite a lot of information, including the fact that somebody was paid to bring the ship to Newport aid ship to Newport at that time, and other people were paid to repair the ship at Newport, and it was similar size, and it was in 1469, we should spot on the date. So with a lot of arguing, you know, it didn't prove anything according to some, but I think the experts as a whole realised, you know, there was nothing else they could compare it to. So I'm pretty certain, you know, you can never say never, but 99.9% certain that the references were relating to Newport ships. So I was able to bring in this royal connection and the Walls and the Roses connection, which is what you'd expect. And this led to all sorts of other discoveries of the historical nature in particular. So that was my contribution, if you like. And
would you describe it, the Newport ship, as your the jewel in your crown, or are there other things that you would just consider?
My crown? Well, it's certainly the sort of biggest individual item I've ever had to deal with, if you don't count buildings. But I've been on sites all over the place. I was up on Hadrian's Wall, down in the Pyrenees, involved in the Fishbourne Roman Palace excavations, and I've discovered lots of different things in my different jobs just by going out and looking. But it was interesting with this, because by using a location where the ship was found, I was able to prove, really for the first time, that we knew that Newport was a walled town. And so that was another project which went from there, and I was able to prove where the original Merringer's house was and what the layout was and so on and so forth. So I became Mr. Medieval Newport, very much so. But even the eminent archaeologists had to, or historians at that point, had to agree. And be fair, they got tremendous backing. And
professionally, you know, not just the ship, but all those other finds along the estuary, it must be an incredibly rich period to be working in.
It is, but there are two things. One is that if you drop something in mud and it gradually becomes anaerobic, and there's no air in there, it gets preserved. For instance, at Caldicot, they're even finding ladybirds mixed up with it, with, you know, killed still red with the black spots on. When we were digging out the trackway, which we call the Upton trackway, that had leaves, twigs, and very fine material, because it was buried and it wasn't disturbed. And nobody knew it was there, and there it remained until you got one of these really fierce storms, which could happen thousands of years later, which exposed it. So
was the Upton trackway? What was that?
Well, that was our first trackway we discovered with Derek Upton. We called it the Upton trackway because it was after him.
Near Sudbrook, was that in
the it was near Chapel Tump, where the other site was. It was near Magorp Hill. That was one of the first things we discovered. So, you know, and all the miscellaneous stuff, but yes, it was incredibly rich. There are all sorts of other fascinating things. For instance, there's an area which goes all the way along the side of the Wentloot levels, and we were looking elsewhere as well, but along the Wentloot level, you could go and you could pick up sort of Spitfire shells, you know, from using it as a firing range for practicing Spitfires. In fact, there's a Spitfire that was buried there and Derek helped to dig out. In the same area, you could find sort of 19th century lead shot. So they're using it as a firing range there. From the prehistoric period, we were finding things like arrowheads. So, you know, it's sort of the same purpose been there, even though the conditions in the land, you know, the sea levels have gone up and down. Sometimes it's been wooded. Sometimes the floods have come in and compressed it and the peat, and so it all became mudflats again. So there's a whole series of dynamics going on there. And it's a massively complicated area, and lots of people are looking at that sort of side of it.
You said that you found out there in the estuary, you found ancient butchers and ranks.
Yep. Yes, I'll have to. You'll have to go up to the den and dig out some of the photographs just to show you. But yes, and a lot of them are obviously now recorded. And there was a 7 levels research committee set up, which I no longer involve in because I'm sort of retired too far now to get back into that side of it. And lots of these discoveries are published in there and published in different magazines. Lots were in the papers. And a selection you can see, obviously, still in the museum in Newport. But that's only a tiny tip of the iceberg to what was discovered.
And they were... Sorry.
Gary, I was just going to ask, because, of course, you've had very deep involvement in Newport heritage for quite a long time.
Mm.
Prior to the Newport ship discovery, did you detect that there was a sort of long-term build-up of frustration with the council's approach to heritage, or was it a very sudden thing in 2002?
Well, that was that specific point. To be fair to the council, when I arrived in 1983, they'd just built a new museum. Well, they'd built a new museum. They were in the process of wanting it updated and improved. And I got tremendous support. Mm. And, of course, they did the same thing with Tredegar House. I mean, they took on that when it was in danger of being demolished.
Yeah.
And now with the National Trust, of course. There was some money around. So I wouldn't say that was the case at all. There could be a bit, on the planning side, there could be a bit bad, in a sense that they didn't seem to realise that... a lot of the historic buildings they had in the town, which disappeared. And, you know, basically anything that could bring a job took precedence over any of the cultural side. But that was a planning issue, really. Not, you know, supporting the actual facilities which we had was different. And that attitude obviously has changed over the years. And now, you know, it was very strict. Planning guidance terms, and so, and they've got a very good team, or did have when they had people looking at planning matters and so on. So I don't see that as a particular problem. But no, there was no problems at all until this bloody boat came up. Oh, we are, I have to delete bloody, but because that, you know, was holding up another key project. And so when it came to the Arts Centre or Arts Theatre, all this dubious, yet another boat, there was, there was no question in their own minds, you know, just keep quiet about it and get it out of the way as quickly as possible. And they failed.
You stuck your neck out then a bit, really, didn't you?
Well, they couldn't affect, I got my pension, they couldn't do anything about that. But what they did do, that was... about that time, was that when Glamorgan Went Archaeological Trust, who hadn't been involved in saying anything about it, finished their contract, they said, right, we're not going to pay you. They said, you said 6 weeks, it's taken 6 months, you know, we're not paying you after the 6 weeks. This was despite the fact that they'd never seen anything about that before. They'd been monitoring all their records, including how much they were paying staff and the rest of it. And it nearly brought the trust down. So I was very involved in that. In fact, I've still got the papers, although the more sensitive ones I put in the embargo on and sent to the Gwent archive. So, but, you know, it was a very nasty business, and there was a... It went on for ages, and fortunately, all those involved in it have now gone, and it didn't help them anyway because they've been told by their conservator, Kate Hunter, that the gallery they were putting in and it would not fit the ship. The experts have come along and said it wouldn't fit the ship. Staff at the museum and elsewhere were told under threat of losing their jobs and discipline if they said anything other than the party line, that they were for the chop. But we knew it wouldn't work, and it was only after most of these people had sort of seen the writing on the wall and left, I won't mention any names, but that they appointed a new guy who was then a sort of museum services manager, that's Mike Lewis, who is still there and has gone through hell of a way, you know, with all the cutbacks and everything else, but he's kept the project going, and he backed the conservator and backed the other people, and he convinced, he convinced the council that they were right. What they were told was wrong. I remember going to a meeting much later on, and there were some councillors there. Some of them would just glare at me, and it was a came political, you see. Yeah. And but one of them, sweet old guy, who said, "Will our ship fit in that basement?" And I said, "Well, some of it would." Trying to be diplomatic, but the message got out, because obviously they'd heard it at sort of highest possible levels, but they just wouldn't take advice, and they paid the price, you know. Well, we paid the price, they've just gone on and elsewhere, but anyway, there's been total change around in regime, support is there. And the big problem these days is austerity. It isn't, you know, the support for the project. The support is there, but they've got to get money to do it. So,
Do you generally think the outlook for the ship is quite good at the moment? Or
I think so. I think so. Right. Whether it will be redisplayed in my lifetime is another matter. Last I heard, and I'm not really up to date with it, you'll have to talk to Mike Lewis. It was the idea was to sort of put it on the top of the present museum, or to that building. So, because one of the troubles about having a new museum, a new display, it's not just the cost of putting it in, the capital cost, if you like, because that can usually be found from lottery heritage or whatever. It's the running costs. But of course, if it's part of an existing project, which is why they want it in the riverfront, there are people there, and the building is there, and so it's sort of much more economical. But but there were huge problems and very sort of vicious things going on, and which I perhaps better not go into now.
Was it fortuitous that you met Derek Upton?
Very fortuitous. Derek just happened to come into the museum when we were wanting material. So I said, "Where did you find it, Derek?" And so he took us out there, and from then on, you know, he'd been telling people about what he'd been finding for years, and the odd things which had been taken normally by National Museum or something like that, they'd accepted, you know, bronze spearhead, this sort of thing, but nobody had really wanted to go out with him, you know, and we just went everywhere together, you know, became really close friends, and went round to his house and heard all these rambles and recollections, and he was divorced, and he had his son Dean was living with him, and he said one of the reasons divorce went through was because of his collecting, and including he'd found this sort of big cannonball which he'd brought in and put by the back door as a doorstop, and thought nothing about it until it started weeping something out of it. And anyway, eventually somehow somebody in the know said, "Well, I think you should get the bomb squad in," and they did, and it'd been full of nitroglycerine, and so maybe she had a point. But he collected all this stuff. It had, you know, massively he gave to us, very generous with it. But
he wasn't an archaeologist, or he was just an enthusiast.
He was out there, you know, he lived his life there. And he worked in a steelworks for a long time. But what he was the honorary warden for the Severn Estuary for the Gwent Wildlife Trust, which incidentally I went on to be the deputy chairman of as well. So he was involved in Magor Marsh and all these projects, and in the Severn Estuary. So he became Mr. Severn Estuary and knew a lot about it. And of course, in the course of that, he got into the archaeology, and I think the natural historians and the ecologists were a bit worried that he was going to sort of give up all that side of it and do it. But of course, they're so interrelated that it was just marvellous. And much later on, I was invited by the Gwent Wildlife Trust to do a survey from a historical archaeological point of, I think, 14 of their sites, including Maygole Marsh. So that, you know, I found a lot more information that way. And that was after I'd retired from the museum. So,
were the reams, you know, a rich source of archaeology? Did anything emerge from them?
Yes, lots of stuff. Again, it's a matter of finding it. You know, if it's in the ground, how do you know it's there?
Yeah.
Well, of course, when Gwent Euro Park went in near what's the name of the hill there, near Maygore anyway, that's when the Barlands Farm boat came up. But a bit further on, they found huge pits and remains of a Iron Age settlement there. There have been obviously monastic settlements on there. A lot of people got very interested in the draining of the levels and the sea walls, and lots of arguments even today on the dating of things. And so there's a lot of trading doing. And certainly on the Rumney levels, which is the other side of Newport, they the University of Reading got very actively involved in doing sedimentology, and with their archaeologists discovered a whole series of reams which went beyond the seawall into the floodplain, well, the floodplain onto the intertidal area, and these were Roman, you know, so the Romans had been doing it. So it's a hugely complicated area, masses and masses of reports. I hesitate to take you upstairs because where all my working notes are and everything, because it's in a mess, but I can show you up there if you want, and you can see the sort of stuff I've got.
So before you came here, Bob, where had you been? I mean, because it's massively interesting, unusual landscape, isn't it? Mm. You know, with the water drainage and the rains.
Oh, yeah.
Did you have... Was that a surprise? Was that a bonus?
Well, I knew the levels were here, because I was actually, for 9 years before that, I was curator at King's Lynn Museum, which is on the edge of the Fens.
Oh, goodness.
So, I mean, we'd involved in the archaeology there. Mm-hmm. Didn't find King John's treasure, but we found lots of other stuff, and there was a massive amount of stuff that came out there. And also industrial archaeology with the draining of the Fens and so on. So the levels was, you know, it's like repeating myself in many ways, so that's sort of where my interest in it. So I had a good idea what was going on here.
You mentioned that you filmed or took photographs of the last Putcher Rank at Goldrive.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
When was that?
I did it on slides. Mm. So I'll have to look at the slides. And
is that because you knew it was coming to an end? And they had to be recorded?
No, it's just because it was interesting. I didn't know it was going to end then, but it ended soon afterwards. It was just a nice picture. I took lots of them. I got a lovely one, which is about a mile out in Yestry, looking back towards Goldcliff Point. And just in front of me is a big pool about the size of this room. In the middle was a red Renault 4, half submerged in the water, looked brand new, and sort of wondered if there's somebody still in it, but there wasn't. But you found all sorts of stuff dumped by the ships there.
What sort of things?
Well, lot, for instance, to give you an example, around Nash, there are sort of banks going on either side of the Usk, and the ships used to dump everything out of there. We got sort of bits of, I've got a few bits upstairs, but there are a lot in the museum. We've got things like shipping lines, porcelain, but above all, things like clay pipe bowls. Derek had hundreds of these he'd picked up. I've got four or five upstairs. Pottery, obviously. Wooden stuff. There's a ship's fender, which we picked up, took back to the museum. Stuff washed out, and prehistoric stuff from elsewhere. Everything under the sun you can think of, you know. And it all get washed up against the seawall or the high tide mark, so...
So you arrived in the early 80s, and then the Dockland area, would have been still an active place then?
Oh, yeah, it had been going... I think the town dock was about 1840, was it? Or earlier than that, I can't remember. I'm using all this stuff. I'm going senile, you know. But anyway, so that's early 19th century. So, and Newport was a massive port because of... it's where the canals and the railways came from the valleys, bringing down iron and coal and stuff. You know, it wasn't ever as big as Cardiff, but it was vastly important. And this was the Lord Tredegar or the Morgan family at Tredegar House that owned, lots of the land here, had what was called the Golden Mile, which is the railway which went through their land and their estates, and every truck they got a payment on, so they became vastly wealthy. And so they paid for huge amounts of things in Newport, rebuilding and so on and so forth.
I was just wondering, because the docks are now by all accounts, you can't just walk in anymore.
No, you can't.
Jan, for example, has got the fantastic interview with a woman who was a prostitute there during the war, for example.
Yeah.
And, the colour...
Down at the Waterloo Arms, no doubt.
Yeah. Well, I just wonder whether, as a curator, whether one records what's happening now. I suppose it's probably what we're doing.
Yeah.
Because I imagine...
To a degree. It depends... because it depends... whether you've got the time, because lots of people... I've been down there quite a number of times, and you can still get on the docks quite easily, because I took my scrap boiler, when they put a new boiler in, a hot water boiler is a copper one, got 60 quid for it. That was well worth it, went down there. And with the flimsiest of excuses, you can get down and see, obviously it's... not a patch on what it was in its heyday, but it's still a very active port.
Mm. Tredegar House, I should ask you about that, really. Mm. So your time working in Newport, what was your contact and with
Tredegar? According to my job description, I was responsible for overseeing Tredegar House. And there was a really brilliant guy called David Freeman who knew exactly what he was doing, running it. And so I said, no, you do what you want, David. I'll just support you. So he did that. But when he left, I went down there and worked for a little while just to help things tick over. But
was it open to the public then?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, but in those days they were guided tours. A lot of the rooms were being... it was still empty, it was still are. And it was just a long, long business of finding bits of stuff to go in there, particularly things which had belonged to the family. And so stuff came in, sometimes it was bought, sometimes it was on loan, and sometimes it was given. So that process is still going on. The restoration work, it's always needed lots doing to it, and it still does. So it's one reason why now the National Trust are taking it on, because council could no longer afford it because of the austerity measures, and it saved it, So. But if it hadn't been for the early days, particularly David Freeman and then director Alf Robke and others that supported him, it wouldn't have survived. And he had great fans as well. Princess Margaret, when she was dying, was one of his personal friends. So she would come down and have tea in his cottage by Tredegar House, and so he knew everybody, and we might sort of interfere with that. So I just mainly concentrate on the museum.
So what was his background then? What do you know?
David. Oh goodness. I'm not sure about his early history. He's still around.
Is he?
Oh, yes. Mm. He was a close friend of... who's the fashion designer? Cecil Beaton, is it?
Oh, really?
Yes, very, very... When I say close, I mean close. And when Cecil died, he inherited his house and everything else, so he lived there. But he's a really enthusiastic, effervescent sort of character.
Well, he must be rather ancient, though, surely.
He's younger than me.
Gosh, he must have been a very young friend of Cecil Beaton, then.
He was a young friend. I won't go into that.
Does he still live locally then?
Well, he lives. It's out in. Oh God, I can't remember the name of the place, but it's Cecil Beaton's house, which is sort of. I don't know, somewhere Hampshire or somewhere around about there. I'm not sure where. He did have a flat at Cardiff Bay.
Okay.
And of course, when he was working, he lived in a flat at Tredegar House. So.
Okay. So it'd be interesting to talk to him, maybe.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Yes.
I don't suppose you have a contact, do you?
Well, I send him a Christmas card, and then he sends me one the next year. So I then send him one the year afterwards.
Yeah.
But I've got his address. Somewhere.
Yeah, it might be really. If you would.
But I mean, Tredegar House would know where he was.
Yeah.
I mean, he's still involved in schemes there, like there's a voluntary scheme for helping people with mental problems in the gardens and so on. And he's been very actively involved in that. So.
They're unlikely to give me his number, though, aren't they? That Tredegar House are unlikely to give me his address, I should think.
Well, you may be able to contact him there, but if not, I'll have to just have to dig it out.
Yeah,
that's all.
I'd be grateful, thank you.
So
just on the levels, it sounds a bit of a cliché question, really, but is there any find you've discovered that you that really sticks, apart from the ship, that really, you know, stays with you?
Well, and the Barnes Farm boat, of course.
Yeah.
They were the two major ones. Mm. I think it's just the quantity of stuff, you know. Mm. The most exciting moment was the village at... in the Iron Edge village, which we discovered near Goldcliff of Pill. And because you were just going, you're finding one thing, and then Derek and myself and about three or four others, and then there was something else, and then there was something else, and then there was something else, you know, and you knew exactly what it all was, and you just couldn't believe it, you know. It was
must have been overwhelming
trying to curate
all this.
Well, it was there, you know, and you went back to the foreshore again and onto the bank, and it all got covered by the sea, but I mean, that's what happened there was, of course, that Martin Bell, I don't know if you've come across Martin, he came along and said, would you mind if I deal with some of this stuff? No, go ahead, Martin. So, you know, it had the proper people and the proper resources went into it, and some massive reports came out. And he's still working there.
Yeah, he's on my list of people to interview, actually.
Mm. He's a great guy, and he did it properly.
Did you ever come across Sir Hanbury Tennyson?
Yes.
Pontypool Estate?
Yes.
So did you have, what sort of dealing did you have with the Pontypool Estate?
A huge amount, because I knew him through the Monmouthshire Antiquarian Society.
Mm.
And I wasn't really studying his papers as much as going to the Gwent archives and doing that, which I had close connections with.
Mm.
And they were tremendous when I was doing my medieval Newport, because they were finding stuff all over the place and telling me about it, you know. So.
Wow. Actually, we've got a meeting. We're going there next Thursday afternoon.
Oh, well, give them my regards.
Yeah.
Particularly Tony Hopkins, who's...
Tony's at Ebervale.
Yep.
Yeah, so we're going to the Glamorgan one.
That's in Swansea, yes.
So did you meet Tony again?
Oh, I knew Tony.
Oh.
Because when he was at the Gwentalco. Oh. He translated a lot of the documents from the Warwick letter and so on.
Oh,
for
really?
Me.
Gosh.
So he was a great supporter, and I don't think I could manage it without him, actually. So.
So is he a Latin scholar then? Is he?
Well, he can read medieval Latin, and which I can't. Well, I try, and I get the odd words, you know. although the word letter was written in English, but it's still sort of old-fashioned English. So.
Are there any other characters you've met over the years that
yes.
you should record?
Yes. Well, unfortunately, you can't record Derek.
No.
Because he's not there. Colin Titcomb, have you come across him?
No.
Oh, get him. He was a great friend of Derek's, and he's involved with the Gwent Wildlife Trust. Mm. I'm sure they would put you straight on to him.
Yeah.
And he used to go around giving lectures, and they used to have the groupies that go around. And he found stuff for us, and he set up a reserve at Brockweir or somewhere. Anyway, it's actually not far again from Magor,
yeah.
the village of Magor, mm-hmm. and it's now a trust reserve, and was his family's farm. And he knows a huge amount. I mean, he concentrates on the natural history, but also about living there. So
that's what the reserve is at Magor?
Not the Magor Marsh Reserve, the Brockwell Farm, which is another reserve in the area. I'm going to have to take you upstairs. I'm going to have to apologise in advance, because the working area is up there.
Oh, don't worry. I mean, that would be fantastic. Shall I turn this off? Then?
Yeah, you can do.
Bob, that was fascinating. Mm. Thank you so much. Mm. Thank you so much.
I was just wondering if, over the years, you've had much involvement also with the Transporter Bridge.
Off and on. It didn't used to be part of the museum collections. Now Mike has got it as part of the museum collection. But I had to write some articles for it and do a bit of research in it. And of course the Newport Shift staff are involved. But apart from doing historical stuff, and my biggest contribution regarding the Newport Transporter Bridge was when I arrived and I wanted a display put in about it, and I had a contact, Derek, no, not Derek, was it? Anyway, a guy who made models, and I got in touch with him, and he did almost as a labour of love the model that's in the Newport Museum now, which was then working, so the thing would go back, and that's a fantastic model, so I was responsible for that coming.
Did you ever use it?
Hmm?
Did you ever use the bridge?
Oh, yes.
Hmm.
Yeah. Which model or the real one?
The real one.
Oh, yes. Well, yes. I've been across it on foot and on car and over the top and everywhere. Yes, of course.
Did you ever hang beneath it? I've spoken to a couple of people who used to hang beneath it and then drop off.
No, it never really appealed to me. I thought, knowing me, I'd probably hang down and jump straight into the gondola or something. But no, it's a rather silly idea.
Yes.
I think when people commit suicide that way, or on the Severn Bridge, they did the same.
Have you ever found any bodies in the peat?
Sort of lots of skulls and stuff like that. In fact, I've had a very long argument with Nigel Nailing, well, not argument at all, but discussion, I should think would be a better way of putting it, because when the Newport ship was excavated, where the struts supporting the ship were, beneath that they found a skeleton, a headless skeleton. And immediately people were talking about it being sacrifices and everything else. But It predated the ship, in fact, turned out to be Iron Age, or everything seems to be Iron Age. The people who were writing the report were talking about it being, you know, headless because of the head was sacrificed separately. Well, they didn't have Derek Upton's experience, nor of him talking with the police, which I listened to. And all the time you find bodies of people which have drowned in the Usk or in the Severn, you know, happened frequently. I can come into some nice gruesome stories now. But anyway, so basically what tends to happen is if somebody either dies or commits suicide or falls overboard, their body floats, and it will float up with the tide, which is a massive tide, and then out again. So it'll go in and out. Now, the weakest point in the body is in the neck. So the necks tend to come away and the heads go off. So if you then find a headless body alongside the bank, you know, you can assume that it's not necessarily a human sacrifice or anything like that. There are other things, I mean, at least the Derek stories rather than me, because he used to tell them all to me. There was one case just on the other side, on the Bristol side, but he was trying to cross over at low tide, and he came across a pair of boots which were upright like this, with human bones sticking in either of them. Someone got stuck in the mud.
My goodness!
Yes. So I then went on.
I mean, that's almost comical but tragic.
I know, yes. And then I went on, you know, because lots of people get trapped because of quicksands out there and everything.
Yeah.
And the mud is thick, you know. Number of parties we've taken out there, and they've lost their wellies. I mean, I did it, but then we get blase about it. We take the students out there, and they're all stuck, and we're just sort of walking around because we know how to walk in the mud. And so they're always coming back covered in mud. You know, we used to be washed down in the house when we came back because we're so bad. But I said to Derek, I said, "Well, did you ever get stuck there?" And he said, "Oh yes, once." He decided he'd walk out to Denny Island, so he went at the very lowest tide possible. But there's a channel between Denny Island and us, and he just couldn't get through the channel, so he didn't get that way to Denny Island. So he started walking back, and he got stuck in some mud, and he couldn't get out. And so he was lying flat on his face. So I looked at him and said, "Well, Derek, so why are you still here today then?" He said, "Well, when the tide came in, it sucks me out, and I swam in with the tide."
Wow.
But the number of people have tried that and it hasn't worked. So it's really tragic in a sense, the way he died in the end, which I won't go into.
No. What other stories did he tell you, this adventures out in the estuary?
Oh, well, I mean, the Spitfire was quite a good one. But they knew the Spitfire, so he helped to dig it out. They come to me and I go, you know, but... some of the unusual stuff he's found. There was one occasion when I went out with him and another friend of mine called Roger James and his wife. And Roger is, he probably still is, the president of the Gwent Wildlife Trust, whatever the title is. But a very nice guy and very knowledgeable. He found this enormous long bow. Oh, we found this, about this long. And so, whilst I was there with Derek and Cindy, who was his friend, and Roger, and we wandered along, and we said, "Well, we'll have to take this back because it could be a sort of giant aurochs." So Roger had to carry this thing, bloody thing, miles back over the mud to the bank till we got it there. And so we got it back to the museum and actually got an identification done on it, and it was a giraffe leg bone. So it's amazing what you find out there. It's really weird. But lots of stories about Derek, I mean, of him wandering out there. And discovering things, but I think it was getting his things, his knowledge out there. And it came to the point, you know, when I certainly wasn't sidelined, but I left them to it. And he would talk to Martin Bell, for instance. None of them would go out without Derek, because Derek knew so much. And they would say this, that, and the other, and he'd say, "Oh, no, it isn't. He wasn't a trained archaeologist or an academic." He'd just say, "No, that could hurt." No. And so they'd all sort of think again about what they'd been prognosticating. And he was right. And I think he got an honorary doctorate given to him in university. But he was so modest and unassuming. But he did like taking young ladies out there. And and as I said, sort of, you know, he would take groups out there, and quite often they would get stuck, but he would have to help them out again. But he'd take me back to his house, and he lived there with his son Dean, and he collected crassulas, you know, little plants, so he had them. But the house was just a mass of stuff. He discovered bottles, you know. A lot of these early bottles were quite valuable, you know.
Just as an aside, did the Museum and Art Gallery ever have anything to do with the School of Documentary Photography and David Hearn? And
oh, yes, yes. Mainly through Ron McCormack.
Yeah.
If you come across Ron.
No.
Yeah. Well, I used to be head of the documentary photography thing. And for when I arrived there, he was in the 80s, and he's long retired, but and each year they had what they called the Newport Survey, and the museum would commission them. The students go out and they did all sorts of different subjects. I haven't got any here, I don't think, but they'll have them in the museum, in the library. And they do different things. It might be still working, sort of life down in Pill or whatever it was. Oh. And each student would take a different theme. And they were put together and they would produce a book. And this went on for about 12 years. And we were, in those days, we had some money, so we were able to help fund it as well.
So there's copies at the museum, do you think?
Oh, yes.
Oh, gosh, I didn't, yeah.
Yeah, the whole thing is still there. Mm. I haven't got any copies at all, I don't know why. Mm. But it's well worth, you know, well worth looking at. Because that School of Photography was sort of, you know, internationally well known. And,
phenomenal.
It's a great tragedy when they close the university here. Mm. So.
I saw David Hearn about a fortnight ago, talking to me about, you know, when he set it up. And he was living in a camper van by the lighthouse.
Mm.
The first year of that, which I thought was quite extraordinary. And just going back to the Spitfire, was it shot down over St. Bride's?
Well, it crashed there.
It crashed, sorry, yeah. Not shot down.
Yeah, maybe in Germany it might have been, but so, it might have been shot down, I don't know.
But was the pilot ever identified or anything like that?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was known about.
Yeah.
It wasn't one I was directly involved in, okay. So I can't give you the details.
So were there other things from the Second World War that... and I was talking to a lady last week, that a parachute had come down, and they took the parachute, and she made an Italian POW who happened to be a tailor made her a silk blouse. She kept it for years and years and years.
Yeah.
I just wonder if there's any other things that came.
Oh, there's lots. We didn't talk about the prisoners of war, for instance. Down at Underwood there was a prisoner of war camp there, and lots of prisoners were kept there. And some of them actually came out and worked on farms here. There are lots of evidence, you know, from pillboxes to little platforms for anti-aircraft guns all the way around Newport. And Jan could tell you a lot more about it than I could.
Mm.
So there's lots of evidence and some bombing, but got off lightly compared to Swansea or places like that. Mm.
Well, I'm going to turn this off now, Bob.
Yep.
Thank you. I'm sure we could talk all day.
Of course.
Thank you so much. That was absolutely fascinating.